everyone. I'm Jenna. Welcome back to Cincinnati Zoo Tales.
And I'm Mark. We appreciate everyone tuning in for another episode. Jenna, we're running a sting operation today.
Wow. That was a good one.
Thank you.
How long did it take you to come up with that?
I stole it from our social media team who posted the article. But we're talking about our sting operation today, a big collaboration that our Cincinnati Zoo vets recently had with some friends right across the river. So really excited to get into it. Today we're being joined by Dr. Mike Wenninger. Dr. Mike is the vet at the Cincinnati Zoo from the zoo side of things. So he's the director of animal health for us. He's a veterinarian here at the zoo. We're also being joined by Dr. Haley Jungers. And Dr. Haley is on the Newport Aquarium side of things. So she's a veterinarian at the Newport Aquarium. First off, we know how busy veterinarians are.
Yes.
Thank you so much for taking the time to come meet with us and talk to us about this.
Happy to be here.
Yeah, no problem. This is fun.
Yeah, so we're excited to hear about this joint effort, like a collaboration between both the zoo and the aquarium. We always start off by asking people about how they got into this field or a little bit about themselves. So Dr. Mike, we want to hear about you and we will have you back on. Give us a brief update, or I guess a brief information about how you got to where you are, and then we'll have Dr. Haley tell us a little bit more in depth how she got to where she is.
Sounds good. So I took the scenic route to being a zoo vet and went into private practice after graduating from University of Wisconsin. Then after 14 years of doing dogs, cats, and private exotics, I went into zoo medicine and worked in Fresno at the zoo, and then I moved here as director almost 2 years ago.
And just so you know, you are amazing, and we are so excited that you're here. I'm not kidding. Like, I love that you're here.
That's not just for the podcast?
It's not just for the podcast. No, we are so lucky to have you.
Thanks.
Yes, and I want to hear more about how you went. Like, that had been a big step from, like, private practice to getting to zoos, because there aren't a ton of zoo vet jobs. So is there a brief answer to that? And I'll ask more questions in another episode.
The brief answer is you just keep on working towards it.
Okay.
And, yeah, I had probably 50% exotics in private practice and did a lot of zoo work there. And, someone gave me a chance, and evidently I did a good enough job to stick there. And after a while, did a good enough job to come here.
I think it's incredible. Like, not only a few species, they know everything. Fish to elephants. It's incredible what you guys can do. So, speaking of fish, Dr. Haley, tell us how you got started, and did you always mean to be a veterinarian at an aquarium?
So kind of like Mike, I also took a scenic route, if you will. So after graduating veterinary school, I spent a couple years doing ER and private practice. And unfortunately at that time, COVID had hit. So a lot of opportunities, like specialty internships and things like that, were either really restricted or not offered. So during that time, I volunteered at a local aquarium where I'm from in California, Southern California. And I think I don't even know what year it was now.
COVID blends together.
I know, it blends the last 4 years together. So I believe in 2021, I moved up to University of California, Davis, where I got accepted to a fellowship position. And that position was really neat because it allowed for opportunities in academics and research and private practice and aquaria. So it's structured in such a way that someone that wants to go into aquatics gets a lot of different experiences in a lot of different scenarios. And that's actually how I met Mike, because during that fellowship, we went to the zoo where he was at the time, and helped with their stingray exams.
What a small world!
Yeah,
that's crazy.
What are the odds?
Came full circle, didn't it? after that position ended, I ended up out here getting this position. And then, funny enough, I don't even remember how I found out, but I was like, wait, you're at the Cincinnati Zoo? And he was like, oh yeah, I just moved here. And I was like, I'm right across the river. Like, come on down. So yeah, it's really funny how things worked out.
Yeah, that's so wild. You met and worked together in California and then both end up in Cincinnati/Northern Kentucky.
Tri-state area.
Yes,
yeah.
That's crazy. So did you always like have an interest in exotics, or did you want to go into marine like life as a vet, or did you just want to be a vet in general to begin with?
So it's kind of funny in vet school. You almost don't realize how many opportunities there are, or how many different things you can do. So I always wanted to be a veterinarian, and I've always really loved marine ecosystems and, you know, the beach. Ironic, I know, because I'm from California. I actually got into aquatics by starting out in research with one of my professors. And there's different clubs in vet school that can, you know, take you to different facilities or give you different experiences and introduce you to folks in the field. And that just kind of opened up a lot of doors. And doing externships in vet school at different facilities too, and again, meeting different people and networking and keeping those connections open, it kind of helped me realize, okay, like, it's not some, like, abstract idea anymore, you know, like, I can do it. And so kind of just kept at it for a few years, and here we are.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
It is crazy. Yeah, you guys go through so much schooling and then different, like, externships or internships or whatever, and then somehow know how to take care of all these.
I know. It's incredible.
We give the illusion that we do.
Yeah. Every day's learning.
Oh, man. How was the, like, the kind of culture shock coming to middle America in the Midwest, coming from California? I feel like it's got to be really different, right?
It's really different.
Because you say, like, you're an ocean person. We're far, far away from the ocean.
Yeah, I don't think I'm used to being landlocked yet. I don't think the Ohio River quite counts.
you're overlooking water, but it's not quite the same.
To be fair, I am by salt water every day, so there's that. But I really do like the seasons. You know, we get a lot of, you know, spring and autumn, which sometimes in California it's just a little warm all the time. So,
and sometimes here you get all four seasons in 1 week. So
it's true. It's true. Sometimes I think I can put away the winter clothes, and it's like, no, you cannot. Absolutely, you need that. So it's been good though.
Good. So how did you guys decide you needed to do the stingray operation? Was it something that you do annually and, you know, it's the first time you've ever worked with the Cincinnati Zoo? Or do you know if the aquarium's worked with them before in the past? Can you tell us a little bit about how this came about?
Yeah, so I guess a little bit of backstory. Our facility used to rely on what we call relief veterinarians or contract veterinarians. So there wasn't actually a full-time vet program set up, and that's kind of where I came in. So a couple years ago when I came on is when I kind of started the what we call, like, the preventative medicine program. So being a little bit more proactive with things like annual exams, etc. And so something that we are striving to do is for, you know, our groups of animals that that can, I say tolerate it, but where it's feasible, right, like the stingrays or like our smaller shark species or like all the penguins, is to do routine annual exams. And depending on what species that is, it looks a little different, right? So like for our ray species, it was anesthesia and do some blood work and do an ultrasound and get some body weights and measurements. For things like our penguins, usually we don't anesthetize them, but they still get a physical exam similar to how your dog and cat would at the vet, any preventative vaccines and a blood draw, and they'll, you know, go back on to exhibit. So this kind of stemmed from wanting to, and I maybe say want, but needing, it's something that should be implemented to get their physical exams done, and just knowing how many we have and what the time would look like, and knowing how involved it is, we reached out to Mike and we're like, hey, like, do you guys have any interest in coming to help out? Like, extra hands and more experience is always really nice. So, and they're happy to do it.
Yeah, Dr. Mike, how'd your team take it? Were you guys like, oh man, we got to go over to Kentucky? Like, I don't like that place.
I mean, I try
that
not to.
That 20 minute drive, man, it's a killer.
I try to stay north of the river, but this is one of those times I guess I couldn't really help it. Everybody was pretty excited because we do have some aquatics here, but not nearly the amount that they have at the aquarium. And at our walk over here, Haley and I were talking about how we have lots of furry animals here, and they don't have much for furry animals there, so we don't have much for smooth or, I guess, scaly critters, besides reptiles. Aquatic scaly critters, maybe, would be a better way to put it. So it was great for our team to be able to spend some time and work with species that they hadn't before. It worked out great because, 4 years ago or so, Haley came to my place of work and we worked on rays, and now this time got to return the favor. So overall, it worked out well.
That's so fun. I'm sure all of the vet techs and any vets that hadn't worked with stingrays before were excited for the new experience. And I mean, I have so many questions on how this actually ends up happening. Yeah. So, I mean, how do you actually round them up? How do you do anesthesia on an animal that needs to be underwater? Like, can you go over just how you guys planned it and how it all happened? And I truly just don't get how you get the stingray in hand so that you can do the procedure. So I know there are a lot of them. How many do you have, actually?
Let's there are 14.
14,
yep,
okay.
14 females. And that's a really good question, and it will depend on the animal. So, for our rays, the way it depends on the animal, the way the exhibit's shaped, if there's any other animals in the exhibit, which, fortunately for us, we just have a couple of smaller ground-dwelling sharks in that exhibit. So, we basically sectioned off with a weighted net part of the exhibit.
Okay.
Because we don't want to have to catch anybody twice. So we section off part of the exhibit, and then our biologist, who's in a wetsuit, and we have, we call them the ray trays, which are metal frames with material that has a flap over the top that you can hook. So we kind of guide them to the side, or we, the biologists.
And a biologist at the aquarium is like a zookeeper here, right?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yep. So they'll kind of guide them into the tray, and we pick them up. And the first station that we had has, it's called MS-222. And that's one of the commonly used anesthetics for aquatic animals.
Oh, okay.
So it was already, it's a powder, so it's dissolved into that tub. So if you think...
Oh, I didn't realize that.
Mm-hmm. So if you think of how, a human gets a mask, right? If they're going under a surgery, right? And they breathe that gas in and they slowly, go to sleep. It's kind of similar.
Okay.
The rays tend to be a little flappy, so maybe a little less calm than a human. But
some floppy humans.
So, yeah, true.
And other animals.
So when they breathe that in, because it's dissolved in the water, they get a little sleepy. And so it's a concentration base. So we talk about what dose should we use. We started them at a higher dose, and then once they're a little sleepy, we move them to a tub where we did the ultrasound and blood, but it's a lower dose, right?
Okay.
They're already
yeah.
sleepy. We don't need to keep them that sleepy. So it's more of a stepwise approach to their anesthesia. And the goal is always to have them, breathing on their own. We don't ever want them to stop breathing, right?
Can I interrupt you for a second? This
yeah.
is so incredible. First, I don't understand anesthesia or how it works in general. But that somebody could figure out how to make it into a powder form and put it into water just blows my mind. But when you make this mixture, mm-hmm. do you do it every time for each stingray? Or is the mixture made and the stingray, I'm not asking this well. Do you have to do a new mixture for each?
You don't have to redose it for each ray.
Okay, so it just, holds its anesthetic properies for the whole
yeah.
procedure.
Yeah, for ours it did.
Okay.
If you have longer procedures, sometimes you'll have to redose the water.
Okay.
And, top them off. Mm. Or if they're not breathing as well, sometimes we'll get some, exhibit water, non-anesthetic water, and in a syringe and flush it over their
okay.
gills if they're hey, they're a little deep. They're not breathing as well as we think they should. So that's kind of how the anesthesia works and how the capture works. I know it was kind of a generalization, but...
Well, yeah, and then
yeah.
I had questions about the way it was kind of set up, because at mm-hmm. least the way I understood it from what I read, it sounds like you guys had multiple pools where you were doing some work in one pool,
or
then rotating.
Stations.
Yeah, stations, I guess, is a better way to put it.
Yep.
How did that setup look, and how many keepers, or not keepers, veterinarians on staff did you guys have? I know because some of our vet technicians were there as well. How many people did this operation require? It sounded like a lot.
I was just thinking about this on the way over here, actually. How many people were there that day? To answer your first question, yeah, we have really big tubs that we set up as our designated stations. So we had the exhibit pool, and then we had two I think they were 220 gallons. I don't know. They're decent size, big square tubs. And then the other half of the pool with the non-anesthetic water is where we recovered. So we had, like, you know, one side was catching and then one side was recovery. From our team, we had, let's see, me, tech, two biologists. I think we had five or six people. And then I think from the zoo side, Mike, we have four.
We had two vets, three techs, and our intern, I believe.
Wow.
So 11 to 12 people?
Wow, almost one person per animal. That's wild.
Yeah. Yeah,
it's a big operation.
Yeah.
Now.
Yeah. It is. Yeah. And one of the really important things that we're really thankful to have help with, too, is writing stuff down, right? And so, you know, what time this animal went into the anesthetic, were there any wounds that we noted, where did we pull the blood from? We confirmed they all have microchips, similar to how cats and dogs have a little chip you can scan and it gives you a number. So we confirmed their ID, if there were any ultrasound findings we wanted to note, that's all written down. So we had one person essentially staying with whichever animal was going through their stations, and like that was their ray for that that time being until they recovered. So we had a couple people rotating through that job or position, if you will, that day, which was really, really helpful, because in the moment you think you're going to remember, and let me tell you, you don't.
Yeah, sure, 14. And I guess, like, thinking about it, one per animal is really not that much, because when we do procedures here, sometimes there's like 10 people for one animal.
Yeah, so I'm sure 10 people and one baby kudu.
Yes, exactly. So I'm sure it was a lot. How long did it end up taking from like start to finish?
I think we finished just over 2 hours.
Wow, yeah, you guys were
really efficient. We started early. I think we started at like 7:30, and I think we finished 9:45, maybe 10, so maybe 2.5 hours.
So once the stingrays are out of the anesthetic water, how long does it normally take them to be, like, fully awake?
Not very long. Okay. And we, based on the doses that we have used, or other people, colleagues have used, gives us an idea of, like, what depth we want, right? Like, no one's was undergoing a surgery or anything. So they could still move and, like, flap their wings a little bit for what we were doing. It wasn't invasive.
Okay.
So they wake up pretty quick from that. I think, within 5 minutes was pretty quick.
Yeah. And you talked a little bit about, like, the importance of this being, like, preventative medicine, right? Mm-hmm. We talk a little bit about, like, why it was so important to draw blood and do blood work and what the ultrasounds, like, what were you looking for when you took the ultrasounds, that kind of stuff?
Yeah, so thankfully, I can't remember which institution did it. Someone did a study, I want to say like 7-8 years ago now, of blood parameters in aquarium-housed cow nose rays. So not only was it a captive population, but it was species-specific, which sometimes, even if you have a cow nose stingray and a whiptail ray or something like that, like, there are species differences in lab parameters, and that's just something, this field in general, zoos and aquatics, we don't know all the nuances yet.
Yeah.
So what's normal for one might be normal for the other, and we do the best we can to kind of compare and extrapolate, but having one, that previous data set, and then having our animals' data sets of white blood cell counts and red blood cell counts and liver values and electrolytes, it really gives us, one, a comparison to maybe what other facilities are seeing, but also for our own animals. So if we have one in the future that we notice, hey, like, they're not eating very well or they're acting a little off, and we repeat a blood sample, now we have one from when they had their annual exams and they were healthy and there were no concerns, and that allows us to compare when they're sick. Is there something, you know, internally that might be going on? So it gives us a really good data set for potential future use. And as far as the ultrasounds go, we try to look at everything. We look at they're all females, as we mentioned, so we're looking for any evidence of reproductive disease. We're trying to look at liver size. Elasmobranchs in general are meant to have really, really big fatty livers, if you will, that kind of take up their entire stilomic cavity.
That's
their
so
entire body cavity.
That's bad in humans, right? Like,
like right, you're like, maybe yeah. not for yeah. humans. And that's part of just their normal plasma brain physiology and anatomy. So we're looking at liver size. They have, I don't know that I've ever seen one disease, but I also am unsure if there's any studies out there that have looked at it. But they have what's called a spiral colon, and it's basically their large intestine, and it has folds on the inside that it's thought to help increase the surface area for nutrient absorption. Mm. And that's something I always look at just because it's really beautiful on ultrasound.
Yeah, it's real cool.
Really
yeah.
neat. It looks like you're going kind of like down a spiral tube.
Wow.
It's really neat. But we also look for things like, is there fluid in the coelom? Are there anything that looks like masses or anything that could be a problem? So we just kind of do a general scan just to see if anything looks off or might need addressing.
How did they all look? Did any of them have any issues, or were they all healthy?
No, they all looked great. Both Mike and I, we kind of switched off doing the ultrasounds, and yeah, things look pretty good in there. So fingers crossed it stays that way.
Yeah. I love that you guys are trying to diagnose these problems before they even arise. That's amazing. I'm stuck on this liver thing, though. Like, why are they so big? Like, is it a buoyancy thing? Does it help them in the water? Like,
yeah, so they don't have swim bladders. So part of having that fatty liver, I say with air quotes, is to have that lipid storage for nutrients and also, yeah, for regulating themselves in the water column. Like fish have swim bladders where they can either, gulp air, or they use that to, maintain their position,
yeah.
And the lesmobranchs don't have that.
I guess we should have started off at the beginning more about, like, what type of stingrays and a little bit about the cow-nose stingrays. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us, like, where they're normally found, typically how long they live, things that they eat, or is that not your wheelhouse because you know all of the medical side of things?
Yeah, and it's funny that you say that because I probably could, but a lot of the stuff like that comes from the biologists and the curators too, right? And sometimes I'll be like, hey, how long is this animal expected to live? Because that's
you
not
can't
something
know everything.
Like, I know,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
And that's information that that we use to, if we ever have like a quality of life discussion or like something is sick, like is it something like, are they considered old, right? Like, should we be thinking more like end of life diseases, or are we talking about like, is it young? Like, it would be really unlikely that it was a cancer or something like that.
So we take care of so many animals just in our Africa department, and I don't know the age range of all of our animals at all times because it's too much to remember and all the natural history. So I don't expect you to know like a ton. I know that's on the biologist more to know, but is there anything you can tell us about the cow-nose stingrays? Like where they can be found, that sort of thing?
Yes. So they are found a little bit, I say everywhere. They do tend to prefer the warmer waters. There are, I believe, some populations of them that tend to migrate up and down coastal regions. Their lifespan is probably somewhere around 15 to 20 years.
That's longer than I would have expected.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think we have a mixed population. I think our youngest is about, I want to say 4 or 5, and I think we are going up to 13, 14, but I might be getting my numbers mixed up.
Do you know
there's quite a few of them.
Okay. Yeah, of course. Do you know, would they normally live in groups in the wild? Do they kind of congregate, or is it just they're finding the food and you'd mostly see them solitary?
They are not usually solitary animals. Okay. They usually are schools. Actually, I shouldn't say schools. Does anyone know what a group of stingrays is called? It's fun.
No. Is this in trivia?
I got nothing. It's not in trivia. I got nothing.
Do you know Dr. Mike?
It's like a flurry or something weird.
Well, I mean, maybe. That wasn't
skate.
What I was thinking. But.
That was something
skate
else.
Of race.
You had the first letter right.
Yeah.
A fever.
That's what it was.
A fever, yeah.
Do you know
like
the reasoning?
It's an F something.
How they came up with a fever? Is there anything behind that? Or is it just...
I don't know.
Okay.
I like that.
Yeah. A fever.
We always talk
stingray
about like
fever.
What the groups of animals are
yeah.
called. Yeah, like I haven't heard the fever of race before. That's a new one.
Yeah.
I like to say school.
Yeah. The group.
Group of stingrays. Do you know how warm they keep the water for them? Is it pretty cold, or?
I believe theirs is higher 70s.
Okay.
In our exhibit.
Cool.
There's a little bit of a range.
Yeah. It sounds like there was a lot of collaboration, and everyone had a little bit of fun. Is there anything else about the day that was, like, you know, exciting, or you'd like to share that, like, a funny story that happened, or anything?
I managed to stay mostly dry while everybody else got mostly soaked.
My dad, he was like, I'm not touching that. Nope.
Yep.
Nope. Yeah. Gonna stay dry over here.
Everybody is talking about how cold they were because they were all wet and it was a chilly day, and I'm like, I don't know, I'm fine.
Yes. The waterproof shoes come in handy most days. So, yeah, it was funny. I think our vet tech at Newport, Jolene, she got drenched, her and the Zetex, because they were on the, what we call induction. So going from their exhibit to the anesthesia.
Yeah, they're wide awake at that point.
So when they're in the tray and they're really flappy and they're just causing all of the water to overflow the tub, yes, they got quite wet.
I guess it's good that you didn't have to actually be in the water to do it, but maybe at some point that'd actually be easier to just put on some...
Sometimes being in a wetsuit, you know?
Yeah, just a wetsuit. It's easy. I was thinking waders, that word wouldn't come to my mind, but...
I'll say, how deep is the pool that they're in?
Where we had it sectioned off isn't very deep, so it's probably, oh gosh, maybe 3 to 4 feet, but there is what we call the deep well, where they can go over, and that's, I believe... say like 12 to 15 feet.
Oh, wow.
Okay. So someone could easily, you know, stand up underwater with a decent amount of...
I've been there and I didn't realize it was that deep in any of those spots. So.
Yeah.
Awesome. Do we have trivia today?
I do have trivia if you guys are up for it.
Oh Lord.
Some obviously some stingray related trivia today. You guys are in.
It's usually just a way to embarrass me.
So we're talking about these Kauno stingrays today. First question I have for you is, how many stingray species are there? Not rays, specifically stingrays.
Oh gosh, I don't know the definition of a ray versus a stingray.
You have any guesses?
I'm guessing 26.
26 from Jenna? Okay.
I'm going to guess 126.
Wow, I'm 126 always so wrong.
126 from Dr. Mike. Dr. Haley?
Oh man, I was going to say like 15.
15? You guys are all low. There's a lot of stingrays out there, around 220 species, give or take. They estimate about 220.
What?
It's not, more still being discovered, it sounds like.
Wow. So, I want that list.
Hey, I think I won.
They said overall, for rays in general, there's around 625, 630 species. But stingrays specifically, there's about 220.
Wow, I couldn't
even
believe
it. Just crazy to me. Wild. Yeah, coming into this, I was thinking, like, I was kind of where Jenna was. I was like, I don't know, 25, I don't know. But
wow.
Crazy. So we're talking about these cow-nose rays. And Dr. Haley had mentioned there are some populations that actually migrate. So off the coast of the Atlantic coast here in North America, we do have a population of cow-nose rays that migrate from Chesapeake Bay down to Cape Canaveral in Florida. How many miles is this migration?
Oh, gosh.
One way, not the round trip, one way. Jenna loves these questions.
So good at numbers and geography. Do you guys have a guess?
I'm going to guess 857.
857? Dr. Haley, Jenna, you guys got anything?
1,200.
I was going to say 1,200.
You guys are all a little bit high. I psyched you out with the first question.
Man.
It's about 720 miles.
Oh, Dr. Mike was close again.
Which, if you go...
Is this
right
to let you win?
Right. You need to make me look smart.
I sent Dr. Mike the questions beforehand.
Yeah. I can't be perfect right now.
Cheater.
Just look... be honest.
About 720 miles. So they spend the summertime up in Chesapeake Bay when the water's a little bit warmer. There's a lot of apparently really fertile feeding grounds there. And they can spend the winters down in Cape Canaveral.
What did they eat? Do you know? Did you find that?
They eat like some crustaceans. Please correct me if I'm wrong here. But from what I read, they eat some crustaceans, anything that they can kind of find on the bottom of the seafloor. Okay. Yeah.
Yep.
Is that right?
Yep.
Vacuum it up. Is that correct?
Ours get a little bit of a variety just because of, I think, the nature of the industry. So we give them some crustaceans, squid, I believe scallops, clams, a little bit of the smaller fish species, like some smelt on some days.
Nice, yeah.
So They get a buffet. They eat better than I do.
It'd be interesting to find out, like, the cost difference in feeding aquatic animals versus the zoo animals, but that's all expensive.
Well, we don't have otters who eat, like, a bazillion times their body weight per day.
That's a great question.
We'll have to find out.
That's
someday.
A whole new study.
Yeah,
whole
different episode.
That's trivia for next time.
Yeah. That's right. I'm going to do some research into it. All right, next question I have. One of my favorite movies ever made. In Finding Nemo, the teacher of Nemo's class is a spotted eagle ray. What is his name?
Oh, gosh.
The spotted eagle ray in Finding Nemo.
Are you asking the cartoon name or like the scientific name of spotted eagle ray?
I mean, if you want to give the spotted eagle ray a scientific name, you should win. You win the trivia for the day. But I meant the cartoon name, yeah. The cartoon name.
Mr. Ray.
She got it.
Yes, that was right.
It's Mr. Ray. It's Mr. Ray.
Automatically winning. You got right on.
Yes.
We're pretty generic with that one, Mr. Ray. I love it. All right, last question I have for you. We talked about the sting operation that was done at the aquarium. Sting is also the name of a very famous musician. He was the front man of what band? What band was Sting the singer for?
Oh, my mom's gonna kill me for not knowing this.
Any guesses? It's like a 70s, 80s band. Any guesses out there?
It's not. No, I don't even want to guess. I don't want to embarrass myself. I don't know.
It's the Police. The Police.
I was gonna say that. I'm like, that's not right.
I would have never gotten it.
The Police. Well, thank you guys for playing along. I'm going to give the honorary win to Jenna today. She got Mr. Ray.
Nice. It was the most important question.
To be fair, I have a 3-year-old and he's watched it. I was probably like, I don't know, 3 or 4 months ago. So that helps.
You're
me.
Just doing some advanced research.
There was some like something in there. Remembered that. Yeah.
Well, that's right. Well, Jenna, do you have anything else for our guests while we have them?
Yes, so we end every episode with a, what can I do? Do either of you have something you do at home or you think that listeners might be interested in learning about that they can do?
I'll save mine for my time with you.
Sounds
so,
good.
Sorry, he doesn't have one.
I didn't think ahead, but now I'll be able to think before.
Okay. Okay, pressure's on to Dr. Haley.
So actually something on the walk down here that Mike and I were talking about, because the plant grounds here are so beautiful, but we were talking about gardens and vegetation and food for animals and things like that. So something that we haven't implemented at the aquarium, but it would be interesting to see if we could, is something called aquaponics. And it's essentially, if you have a system of water, preferably with a fish in it, and the waste from the fish will feed plants that some people will like hang the plants above the fish tank, or there's a lot of different setups out there, but as far as being a little bit self-sustaining and you know, like growing your own vegetation at home, that's something that might be a little bit more in-depth of a project, but I think it would be really cool to see if we could implement something like that. My technician actually was talking about it a long time ago. We were just kind of spitballing. You know, we have a lot of fish that get vegetation food items, whether that be for, you know, nutrition, enrichment, etc. So it would be really neat to see if that's something that we can implement. And it kind of, like I say, it's a little bit self-sustaining where it uses the nutrients in the water that are produced by the fish to help the plants grow, and then you get plants out of it. So,
yeah, I love that
cool
idea.
Cool little project.
I'm sure. Yeah, it might be a little bit to get started at home, but you could grow your own like herbs or something to use rather than going to the grocery for them.
Right.
And then like at
try
the aquarium,
a little bit of like a little basil plant above your goldfish tank or something.
Super cute. Yeah, to have. And also, it's an excuse to get a fish for a pet or a couple fish for pets.
Yes.
Why not? And it'd be really cool at the aquarium to use it as a sustainable way to feed animals while also taking care of the animals. So. That's a fun one, and we definitely haven't done that.
I think there's a lot of potential with it, too, right? Like, especially for people who are living in cities that might not have, like, a backyard where you can just grow any herbs or spices or anything like that. Like, Maybe get a fish.
Indoor plants, hydroponics. You know?
Yeah, there you go. Exactly.
Awesome.
I love it.
Well, thank you so much for coming to the zoo and chatting with us. And I'm so glad that we had Dr. Mike and you guys got to work together again. I think that's kind of hilarious how that worked out. Both of you.
It's a small world.
It is. It really is. Especially in the zoo world, it makes it even smaller. But still, very cool. And I'm glad that you guys were able to collaborate and all of your stingrays were healthy.
Yeah.
So that's awesome.
Thanks for having me. This was really fun.
Yeah.
Yeah. Shout out to both your teams for the collaboration, like Jenna said. Like, it's, you love kind of seeing in the zoo field when we can come together to farther advance animal welfare, animal health care, all that kind of stuff. So you love to see it.
Yeah. So are you the lone vet at Newport Aquarium right now?
Yep, it's just
okay.
Me.
Wow. Okay, so you probably have a lot on your plate.
Yep, just a little.
It's okay. Just a little bit.
Maybe you guys will get to work together again and doing more preventative care.
Wrote Mike in for some, you know, more help and hands in the future.
Happy to help out.
Awesome. Well, again, thanks for your time. I know you are both busy. And we hope everyone listening has a great day.
Yeah. Take care, guys. Until next time.